Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, Part 3, the third talk in a series titled Ethics of Sex in the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 14, 2014, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number one, Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're in our third session of Ethics of Sex in the Bible, and we're in the part one, which has to do with the relationship between biblical sexual ethics and modern culture. And we're spending a little bit of time on this because that's the biggest challenge, is to how to make sense of biblical ethics in our world, in the world today. So far we've talked about, these are the assumptions that you have to have, I think, to share this part of the biblical worldview in order to make sense out of biblical sexual ethics. And these are assumptions that are not readily understood and grasped and accepted by modern people because it's so much at odds with modern culture. So far we've looked at the biblical worldview assumes the teleological structure of reality, and that includes human sexuality. Everything in the created order has some kind of design and purpose and function and role that is built into it by the author of all reality. So if that's the case, that includes human sexuality. Human sexuality is what God designed it to be. It's not something thrown into existence for us to do with whatever we want to do with it. That's the implication of that. So that assumption is embedded in the foundations of the biblical worldview, but it's kind of only on the margins of modern culture. We selectively accept that or don't accept that as we will. The second assumption is that from a biblical perspective, what's foundational to the biblical worldview is God gave us a mind, reason, rationality to try to come to make contact with his reality and understand it. So when that comes to moral judgment, we make moral judgment based on what my reason, and hopefully that's sound reasoning, but what my reasoning would lead me to commit to as true, rather than what feels true or what looks true or what seems true to me. And again, that's a significant difference between what's at the foundation of the biblical worldview and what's more comfortable to us today in our culture. So rational judgment over feeling, personal rational moral judgment over culture, that's where it becomes the most important, because we are so much shaped by and molded by the culture around us that our values, our perceptions, our perspectives, our priorities, everything ultimately can be and typically is a reflection of what the culture has made me to be. That, I think, is exactly what Paul meant in the New Testament when he says, we walk by faith and not by sight. What he means by that is we walk by rationality, we walk by reason, we walk by knowledge, we walk by what we know to be true, not by what looks true to us. That's one of the fundamental struggles of discipleship, of following Jesus, is learning to credit what I know over and above what looks true to me. And again, that's because what looks true to me is typically dictated to me by the culture, not by sound reason and moral judgment. And that's why Paul also says, do not be conformed to this world, the culture that this world creates. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. That is, let your thinking be completely revolutionized by the instruction of God, in whatever way and it comes to us. Let us be transformed in our thinking. Don't just simply be a reflector of the culture around you. So that was the second point. Rational judgment over what seems right, what looks right, what feels right. The third one is that in the biblical worldview, I am fundamentally and primarily a person. And then by a person, I mean a being created in the image of God. I am not primarily and fundamentally who I am in my physical body. What's essential is my personhood, not my organism. And I would argue that it's most helpful to understand the biblical perspective as a person that has been given by God a body through which to express itself. But the body that I have been given through which to express myself is temporary. It was never intended to be an eternal aspect of what makes me, me. And quite clearly, the biblical worldview is one day this body is going to go away, is going to be done away with, and I will receive what Paul calls a heavenly body to replace this earthly body. So since it's not permanent, since it's not eternal, since it's not an essential aspect of who I am, it's not really the most important and primary thing that makes me me. And that body, I would argue, includes my sexuality, at least my physical sexuality. We'll talk more about this later. I'm not sure that maleness and femaleness necessarily goes away, but the physical manifestations, the animal aspects of my sexuality are going to be left behind one day. And why is that relevant? Well, that means it's just too simple to suggest, as I was very much inclined to back in the middle 20th century through the encouragement of my culture, it was just too simple to suggest that sexuality, because it is made by God and because it is a creation of God, is just absolutely wonderful, beautiful, and to be fully embraced and accepted. That's true. That's very true. It is a creation of God, but it's too simple to just leave it there, because my sexuality is created by God, but it's the less noble aspect of what makes me me. What makes me essentially me transcends that. And one day I will transcend my physical sexuality and I will still be me. So my physical sexuality is something that actually only becomes noble as I, to use the New Testament term, as I sanctify it. It's not inherently holy. It's not inherently wonderful. It's not inherently this good thing that God has created. It can go terribly bad. It can go terribly wrong. And if we don't act sexually and create ourselves sexually in a way that conforms to what God's purposes are for sexuality, then my sexuality actually ends up becoming a part of that which is demeaning to me and not something that is ennobling to me. And we'll come back to that on a point that's coming up here. And then we got to the fourth point, and we just started the fourth point last week when we had to end. And the fourth point basically comes down to what I am sexually, how I think of my sexuality, is something ultimately that I choose. It's not something that God has created me to be. It's something that I choose. So let's look at the notes here and explore that further. I'm on point D, page 6? I'll be repeating a few things here at first, but sexual desires are learned and ultimately chosen. They are not the necessary mechanical result of the biological machine that I am. Hence, sexual behaviors are freely chosen acts for which I am morally accountable. They are not the necessary biologically caused actions of an organic robot. I mean, that's where the modern view differs from the biblical view. It has to be the case. Because if the biblical view shared the modern secular worldview, if it shared the view that we are no more... No, let me put it this way. I am what I am sexually, just as a black man is black, and a left-handed person is left-handed, and a green-eyed person is green-eyed, that we just receive these as a creation of God, and that's all there is to it. If that were the case, it would be completely morally reprehensible for the Bible to condemn, for example, homosexuality. It would be morally reprehensible. Why would you morally condemn that which is not somehow a function of what you have chosen? And now, by choice, recognize there's so much of human behavior that the Bible considers sinful that is only chosen in the philosophical sense. I don't mean that I sat down one day and I deliberated and I consciously decided, well, I could do this or I could do that. I think I'm going to do that, and that's a choice. There's so much of what we do is at the moral level, at the level of moral accountability, a choice, even though I may not experience in my psycho-emotional experience or my conscious experience as a choice. That's not really relevant to the issue, whether I felt like I made a choice. The issue is, did I make a choice? And the biblical perspective has to be assuming, yes, you did, with respect to anything and everything that it holds you accountable for. It wouldn't make any sense otherwise. So the modern myth, of course, is that when it comes to the very controversial issue of homosexuality, the modern myth is that the homosexual is just created a homosexual. The heterosexual is just created a heterosexual. The bisexual is just created a bisexual. That God had different versions of humanity that he created, and that just there's nothing anybody can do about it. That can't be right from the biblical perspective. The Bible can't possibly embrace that as a valid worldview. Now, if in fact that myth is in fact reality and not a myth, there are a lot of anomalies. I mean, a lot of things that they would have to explain. How can we explain the fact that different cultures throughout different times in history have had different prevalence, or what's the word on the prevalence of homosexuality can be virtually non-existent in one culture at a certain time in history and then be more prevalent at another time in history or in another culture? I mean, how do we explain that if we're talking about biology? Differences between the races, possibly, but how do races survive if they are biologically selecting out for against heterosexuality? I mean, there's some weird things there that would have to be explained. I mentioned the documentary that the BBC broadcast about men in America, males in America, who become erotically attached to their automobile. How do we explain that biologically? Is it a mutation? I mean, why would that be at all a part of the biological programming of a human being? That doesn't make sense to me. I read a book years ago by a lesbian feminist, a lesbian feminist who's a geneticist. She wrote a book called The Gene Myth. Now, since then, I've looked up that title, and there's a different book out there called The Gene Myth. I haven't read that. I can't speak to what that book says. This book is probably way out of print by now. But she wrote the book because she was really, really concerned at that point in the gay rights movement. Gay activists were pushing really hard to try to make the case that homosexuality was strictly genetic. And her concern was as a geneticist, to say, that doesn't make any sense. Genes don't do that. And then secondly, as a feminist and a lesbian, her concern was, you have to really be careful socially and politically what you're setting yourself up for. Hitler executed homosexuals to cleanse the gene pool. I mean, among other people that he executed. His goal was to purge the gene pool of genes that were not to his liking. If we link our homosexuality to the gene pool, we are setting ourselves up for another Holocaust, very, very possibly. And that's why she wrote the book. But most of the book is about genetics and how it just doesn't make any sense to think that genetics in and of itself could make someone a homosexual. But why are we so ready to believe that? Because it fits our current modern values, the values that we want to embrace, the values that we want to promote. It ends up being a kind of convenient underpinning, a convenient myth to believe in order to sort of make sense out of that set of values that we're inclined to want to support. So I've already made the point. So the gene myth is culturally accepted myth that shapes most modern attitudes towards sexuality today. Point A, I've already made that point. The biblical worldview and what I would consider to be the half-baked and incoherent materialistic worldview of modern culture, those worldviews are mutually incompatible. Either modern culture has it right or the Bible has it right. I mean, we have to make a choice with respect to that worldview. But if the biblical worldview is right, if it's right, then it is impossible for sexual behaviors to be biologically determined such that a person cannot be blamed for his sexual choices and preferences. That wouldn't make any sense. So we can reject the biblical worldview, and then all bets are off, and then sure, it makes all the sense in the world that you would embrace homosexuality as perfectly valid, perfectly legitimate, perfectly good. That would make all the sense in the world. The question is, which is the correct worldview? I would argue that the Bible would advance an existentialist, what I will call an existentialist account of human sexuality. What kind of sexual being I am is the result of my becoming the kind of sexual being that I have chosen to become. And again, I say chosen, but I'm using that in a somewhat narrow philosophical sense. You know, you don't search your conscious experience and memory and look for where you made the choice. When did I become a liar? When did I become proud? When did I become selfish? When did I become all those things that the Bible condemns me for? Do I remember choosing them? No, but I sure see the pattern of my life. That's what I became. I became all of those things. From a biblical perspective, it's not, well, you were born that way and you couldn't help it, so you're not blameworthy for it. No, of course you're blameworthy for it. It's morally problematic, morally objectionable, morally damnable that I am all of those things. Never mind that I can't remember when in my experience I chose to go that route. It wasn't that kind of choice. So when I use choice throughout here, that's the kind of choice I'm talking about. So what kind of sexual being I am is the result of my becoming the kind of sexual being that I have chosen to become. I define myself sexually by what I choose to desire, what I choose to be interested in, and what I choose to do sexually. Now, I'm going to qualify that as we go through here, but just to put the point on the board. It goes without saying that biology, body chemistry, hormones, all kinds of biological, physical, chemical elements have a powerful influence on various aspects of my sexual urges and attractions. This is undeniable, but my biology, hormones, body chemistry, and so on don't make me act on my urges or my attractions. My genes didn't make me act on them. It may be very strongly instrumental in those urges being there, but my genes didn't make me act. My hormones didn't make me act. If I validate an urge or attraction, it is because I have chosen to do so, not because my genes, my biology, made me do it. So body chemistry and genes may compel a man to be more effeminate, for example, but being effeminate is not the same thing as being a homosexual. Homosexuality is chosen, even if effeminacy is not. It's critical to make that distinction. And I'm using effeminacy very loosely. I may have all kinds of proclivities that culture tells me are feminine rather than masculine. But that's a cultural standard being applied to me as someone created by God to be what I am. There's absolutely nothing wrong with me having those tendencies and those proclivities. And if the culture says you as a male shouldn't have those characteristics, well, then damn the culture. I mean, what does it know? I'm not answerable to the culture in that sense. So those issues are not moral issues from a biblical perspective. Being effeminate in the sense in which I'm talking about it here is never considered evil and perverse in the Bible. If it is choosing to engage in homosexual behavior, that's what's considered the perversion, not the other. So body chemistry and genes, likely in conjunction with cultural factors, and I think it's important to see the interplay between those two things. I have certain proclivities that are probably there because of body chemistry and genes, but they always interact with a culture. That's why behaviors change as cultures change. Cultures encourage or discourage certain behaviors. They validate, they don't validate certain behaviors. And as they do that, people's attitudes change. I mean, I think that's a given. I don't think there's any question about that. So body chemistry, likely in conjunction with cultural factors, may compel a man to find other males sexually attractive, but finding other males sexually attractive isn't, Bible does not. Homosexuality is chosen, even if sexual attraction to males is or seems to be not chosen. In contrast, in the modern mindset, whatever sexual desires and urges one experiences are self-defining urges. To experience homoerotic urges is just to be a homosexual. That's how the modern culture looks at it. I would argue that that's in conflict with the biblical perspective. A male's being sexually attracted to other males is never in and of itself considered evil and perverse by the Bible. It is my choosing to validate that sexual attraction by my attitudes or behaviors. That's what would be considered a perversion. Now later, I'll get to this later, I'm going to make a distinction between a sexual response and a sexual desire. I think sexual desires can be perverse. A sexual response is just a sexual response. And I don't think I'm accountable, morally culpable, for a sexual response. It's a question of what I do with it. And what I do with it determines whether it becomes a sexual desire, I would argue. Let's take it on a less controversial topic. Take races of people who tend to be, or are known for being hot-headed. And I won't name any of them, but you know that there may be, you know, an ethnic group or a nationality where you think of them as, gee, well, I think so. That's why it seems to follow race or family line or genealogies and so on, that family is hot-headed. I think there's a biological element to it there. The fact that I may have some chemically induced, chemically caused proclivities to have a flash response to circumstances, I don't think that in and of itself is anything that the Bible would consider morally damnable. It just is what it is. The question then becomes, what do you decide to do with that? How do you handle that flash response? Do you allow it to become anger, hatred, revenge, pugnacity? Do you allow it to become that? Or do you deal with the flash and resolve it by trumping it with wisdom and righteousness? If you learn to trump it with wisdom and righteousness, the fact that you had the biological response is just the fact that you had the biological response. That's all it is. It's not a moral issue. And I would say analogously, whatever my sexual response is just a sexual response. But then I have to do something with it. And I will either turn it into a desire or I will put a trump card on it of morality and wisdom. Biblical ethics in general is based on the assumption that the good, righteous, and moral man is the man who acts according to what his reason tells him is the good and right way to act and ignores and transcends how he feels like acting. In other words, his existential choices transcend his passions. The Bible would absolutely reject the modern mindset that it is right and appropriate that our actions authentically reflect our desires and passions. I mean, think of all the messages we get in music and the movies and elsewhere in our culture that somehow there's something really noble about acting on what you feel. Now you're being authentic. Now you're being real. Now you're being honest. I mean, we have all kinds of positive virtues that we attach to just letting my passions dictate my responses and my actions. That's not the biblical perspective. That wasn't even the pagan perspective in antiquity. The pagans knew very well that they had to rein in their passions. Those passions could destroy you, so that they had to be reined in. Plato and Aristotle would have said, you have to rein it in with reason. Do what your reason dictates to do. That's not too terribly unlike the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective, of course, ultimately adds the wisdom that comes from the instruction of our Creator, of God. And we know that today through the teaching of the Bible, for example. So to allow what we know to be true from our Creator to honor that and to validate that by allowing that to dictate how I act and behave rather than let my passions dictate how I act and behave. That's just a given in biblical ethics, it seems to me. And certainly it's true in sexuality. We even go so far in the modern world to say a person is defined by his passions, at least in the area of sexuality, that my passions define me. So if I have passions that, if I'm a male attracted to another male, that makes me a homosexual, that defines me as a homosexual. I think Paul would tear his hair out at that. No, it doesn't. What defines you as an individual is what are you personally committed to, and that your personal commitments are dictated by the choices you make, and therefore the actions, not by the passions that you had to deal with, not by the passions that you were interacting with. Yeah.
There's a question from Gil. He's asking, what is the connotation of the word that gets translated effeminate in Corinthians 6:9?
Okay. I think effeminate is probably not a good translation. I think that word is describing some kind of homosexual behavior in that particular case. I can't prove that at this point. To make the case for that would involve an exegesis of that passage and get into the intricacies of that, and I don't want to take the time to do that now. And I might be wrong. I mean, I don't want to just be dogmatic here. I may very well be wrong in my understanding of that word. But at this point, in my judgment, I don't think that passage is defining what we think of as effeminacy as wrong. I don't think it is.
I thought that word, I looked it up once, I thought it was used to talk about, like, there is, like, these men would have boys as, like, their slaves or something like that, and they would have homosexual activity with them.
Yeah.
I think the word was used to refer to that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it could have been more than that. But yeah, it didn't really seem like it had anything to do with effeminacy.
Right. Exactly. It's really difficult because I think the word just means soft, basically. And so it's a question of how it gets used and the context in which it gets used. I don't think you can tell from the root meaning of the word itself. Okay? It seems to me that the history of modern attitudes towards sexuality makes a lie out of the gene myth of modern culture. It was, for somebody who's lived this long, you know, I've seen a complete transformation of cultural attitudes and perspectives toward something like homosexuality. When I was younger, homosexuality was not at all widely accepted, and it wasn't even acknowledged all that much. I didn't even know homosexuality existed when I was a kid, and I barely even knew in high school. That's how easy it was to shelter somebody from those realities. Then, as culture changed and attitudes towards sexuality generally, notice that homosexuality only became widely accepted in the culture after the sexual revolution. So you had attitudes towards sexuality in general changing. Open marriage was okay, adultery was okay, promiscuity was okay, virtually anything and everything goes sexually, and how can you close the door to anyone or anything? Therefore, homosexuality becomes culturally acceptable right along with everything else that has become culturally acceptable. Isn't that interesting that there was a correspondence between the sexual revolution and the openness to homosexuality? And then when homosexuality became widely acceptable, now all of a sudden bisexuality becomes talked about as an option and encompassed in the gene myth. Well, I guess there's not just a gene for homosexuality, there must be a genetic makeup that makes you actually bisexual. And then there's no limit to what you can do. You can assign a pattern of genes to go with any and every sexual choice out there. That's what the myth is for, is to give credence to our cultural values and to give a support to our cultural values. Well, why is that the pattern if it's biological and not cultural? If it's physiological and not choices that human beings in a human culture are making? And in fact, I was talking to a guy just out of high school one day, and he was talking about how his friends would come to school. One day they'd be homosexual, the next day they'd be bisexual, and then they'd be heterosexual again, and then the week after that they'd be homosexual. That's not biology talking. That's someone who's desperately in search of an identity in the context of a confused and dark culture that's not giving them an ounce of help in coming to self-understanding. All it is doing is confusing them, lying to them, abusing them by telling them all kinds of stories that can't possibly help them come to terms with who am I, what kind of being am I, what is my sexuality, and what is it for, and so on. It's that issue that prompted me to offer this class in the first place. There is irreparable harm being done every day by our culture messing with our heads and messing with the heads of young people and young adults and everybody, but especially young people and young adults. It is messing with their heads and keeping them completely lost, confused, conflicted, in agony over coming to terms with their self-identity. And so the reason I'm taking this on is to suggest there's a whole nother way to think about who we are, a whole nother way to think about our sexuality, a whole nother way to deal with our sexuality that doesn't leave us so grounded and adrift and lost and in the dark and ignorant. The Bible tells us what it means to be a sexual being and gives us guidance to land with both feet there and start living our lives in the light of those purposes and therefore define ourselves by our choices and our behavior in conformity to what God said our sexuality is. That seems to me is the critical issue of our day, of our age. And there, even there, the ultimate issue is not, do we get our sexuality right? I mean, even that's not the most important issue. The most important issue is, are we going to be people who care what God thinks? Are we going to be people who want to honor God and his purposes? Or are we going to blow him off? And what the culture is doing is giving us so many ways to justify blowing God off and just telling him he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Well, that's a life and death issue. The issue is my soul, ultimately. Am I going to choose to be a creature created by God who chooses to live his life by honoring him, serving him, loving him, knowing him, and obeying him? Or am I going to take my cues from the culture that says, nah, none of that stuff's real, none of that stuff's true, none of that stuff matters, just go your own way and flip God off. Doesn't really matter. That's the critical issue. And the point of attack in our culture is at the point of our sexuality. That's where the culture is pressing really, really hard on us to ignore God. Has God said that behaving that way sexually is wrong? It's not wrong. You won't die. We've heard that before. We have to take that on. I think sexual orientation is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the culture tells me that certain features that I have out of biological necessity make me homosexual, for example, then I will be inclined, taking my cues from my culture, to make choices that are consistent with my culturally shaped self-concept. And I stress culturally shaped self-concept. I'm taking my cues from my culture. I'm not being fiercely independent of my culture and thinking for myself. I'm just allowing my culture to dictate to me the terms of my existence, to make choices consistent with my culturally shaped self-concept as a biologically determined homosexual. That's what my culture is telling me. My self-defining choices will then define me as a homosexual and mold and shape my sexual orientation and desires. But I can make myself unbecome a homosexual just as much as I can make myself a homosexual by trying to make choices in another direction. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying that the choices I have made will not make that an uphill battle, and I may have to battle desires and inclinations and habits and patterns that I embraced that go against everything that I want to do. But they don't define me. That's the critical thing to understand. That doesn't make me, that doesn't define who I am. What defines who I am is what my heart is committed to. What do I want to be? What do I want to invest my life in? Is it obedience to God? Then that's who I am.
Hi, yes, we have one question from Karina.
Okay.
She's asking, what does Jack think about the gay Christian movement? People who are trying to follow God and who don't see the Bible as calling homosexuality a sin.
I really don't know. I think you'd find all kinds of different people as a part of the great Christian, gay Christian movement. I think some of them, if I were talking to a practicing homosexual and they were asking me, what do I need to do? The first thing I'm going to say is not stop being a homosexual. The first thing I'm going to say is you need to think seriously about what you're going to do with your Creator. What is your relationship with God? Do you want to know him? Do you want to love him? Do you want to fear him? Do you want to serve him? Do you want to obey him? You got to sort that out and figure out how much of a priority that is to you. Once you get that settled out, I'm confident God will help you work through the rest of it. I think that there probably are people in the gay Christian movement who are there. They're in the great gay Christian movement precisely because they have decided that they want to take God seriously. And that's great. That's wonderful. They, I think, are wrong on the issues at this point and are confused on the issues. But there's all kinds of voices to throw dust in our eyes to make us confused. So why wouldn't they be confused? I mean, I understand that. But I would think over time, see, all of us, my perspective is the Bible teaches us the truth. And the more my understanding of the Bible begins to approximate what the Bible actually teaches, the more we're going to find agreement among such people who are seeking to know what the Bible actually teaches. But none of us are there yet. So there are going to be differences of opinion between Christians who really are on the same path. They really are on a journey to know God and love God and obey him. But at this point in their lives, they're not on the same page with respect to particular moral issues or doctrinal issues or theological issues or whatever. Okay, they're not on the same page. But the issue is not where you're at today. The issue is where you're headed. Where do you want to go? What's your ultimate destination?
Derek, just an observation. There's a guy, I think his name is Justin, I'm trying to remember, I've read his book, who runs an organization called the Gay Christian Network, and they specifically, overtly, are there to declare that it is equally legitimate to be a celibate homosexual or to be a sexually active homosexual. And at least that organization, which I think is fairly prominent in the gay Christian movement, basically says either of those positions are legitimate. I don't agree that they're both legitimate, but they have embraced the idea that...
That there may be difference of opinion on conscience, moral conscience,
yeah,
about how to...
differences of opinion and differences of practice. And
yeah,
They seem to, as an organization, they go out of their way to validate both positions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my fourth point. Any other discussion of that particular point?
So you talked about defining homosexuality, that the Bible would not define it as the urges and impulses that your chemistry or whatever has caused you to have, or is causing you to have. And like when you're talking about the Bible defining homosexuality, like what exactly do you mean? Like what concept? Because I mean, I guess do you just mean when the Bible talks about same-sex relationships?
Yeah, when it comes up with a list and says neither this nor this nor this nor this nor homosexuals will inherit the kingdom of God, what does he mean by a homosexual in that case?
Right.
I mean, he follows that with, and such were some of you,
right.
He says. Well, in what sense were, to the modern mind, that's just mind-blowing. What do you mean were? I mean, you're born that way, right? Well, that's not Paul's perspective. That what it meant to be a homosexual that will not inherit the kingdom of God is you are existentially committed to a pattern of behavior and a lifestyle that defined you as a homosexual because it was homosexual activity that you were existentially committed to pursuing. Well, when you became a believer, you stopped that behavior. So you're no longer a homosexual. Now, is it likely that those very people he's talking about had homoerotic urges? I can't imagine not. I mean, sure, they've habituated themselves to that, so why wouldn't they? But Paul does not take the position that defines them.
Okay, yeah. Because, I mean, if I remember right, from what I remember, it seems to me like the word he uses has to do with activity.
I'm sorry,
it has to do with activity. Like the,
I didn't hear the first part of your sentence.
The word that Paul uses has to do with homosexual activity, if I remember right, but I'm not sure about that. I don't know if it was translated well or not, but it seems like today when we talk about homosexuality, it's a broader term than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm wondering, if you want to define it as something, it kind of sounds like you're wanting to, I don't know if you're wanting to change the definition of homosexuality as we use it today, but it seems like there is a group of people out there that have the homosexual impulses and urges that are not participating in activity.
Mm-hmm.
And... like, what term should we use to talk about those people? I mean, you're not saying that you're saying we shouldn't define homosexuality as someone with those urges. We shouldn't define someone as homosexual because they have those urges.
Well, I don't want to be persnickety about the way we use our language. We can use our language any way we want to use our language. I would say they're homoerotically inclined, you know, maybe, and distinguish that from homosexual, but that's weird. So I don't want to impose language on anyone. I just want to draw attention to the fact that behind the use of language in the modern world is a whole concept of personal identity that is not the Bible's view of personal identity. The idea that, I mean, notice we're not even symmetrical about it in the modern world. We don't define heterosexuals by their sexuality. We only define homosexuals, transgender.
Nowadays they kind of do it.
Okay, but that's how out of touch I am. But you don't have, how should I put it? My experience is heterosexuals don't go around thinking fundamentally that what I am first and foremost is a heterosexual. But I think you can find that in certain segments of our culture with homosexuals. They are first and foremost a homosexual.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, from my experience, it seems like there's a lot where that's not like a central defining element, but they say they're homosexual, but that's not what they are first and foremost, but that's just what they are when it comes to their sexuality. But it seems like what you're getting at is something different than that. It seems like maybe I'm trying to understand what you're doing. You're saying maybe that term is used so broadly so that they can basically be like, someone has homosexual impulses or urges. They're just homosexual. That's just what they are. And so then you put them in this big group of people, the people that pursue those and act upon those, and you're just like, well, that's just what they are.
And put them in a culture that tells them, now you really want to be authentic and real and honest in the way you live your life. Make sure it matches your impulses. Make sure it matches your urges. Well, that's a recipe for creating a homosexual in the biblical terms of one actually acting on that and
right.
behaving that way.
Yeah.
Well, why?
Right.
I mean, why do we?
So you're saying maybe if we talk about someone, I mean, because again, like when it comes to this whole thing of choice, like when I have thought about the debate of choice, I mean, it seems like there's two things that you can be talking about. One is whether or not they choose to act on something that's perverse. And another one is whether or not they choose to, I guess I'll just say, have homosexual inclinations or urges rather than heterosexual inclinations and urges. And I feel like the latter one, that's not really a choice. Like, people, I mean, maybe sometimes people can pursue and, like, try to, like, bring those about. I don't really think people do that, though. I mean, I think they act upon the urges that they have, and, you know, both heterosexuals and homosexuals, because we're human beings, end up validating, you know, perverse desires at some point. And so it seems like if the debate is whether they choose homosexual inclinations rather than heterosexual inclinations, then to say, oh, they choose might put you in kind of a silly place. But if the debate is getting down to, okay, are they accountable for how they define themselves as a sexual being, as far as what they pursue or what they want to live in, as far as their actions or whatever, then it's helpful to emphasize the choice, because that has to do with the accountability of the moral actions,
right.
I guess.
Right, and that's the important issue for me right there. I mean, I don't know where any of our inclinations come from, so it becomes kind of a moot point. It becomes a subtle and perhaps an important point with respect to my ultimate anthropology. I mean, leave homosexuality out of it. I mean, ask yourself the question, did you choose to be selfish?
Well, yes, I'm looking at that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So you wouldn't, like, so if you're dealing with a homosexual and they're, because it seems like what happens is Christians will come to homosexuals and homosexuals will be like, my experience, just, you know, these are the inclinations and urges that came to me. And they, you know, because of culture and everything, they're just like, okay, well, that's what's coming to me. And then they validate that, like,
right.
Pretty much everyone does. And so the Christian is coming to them and being like, oh, you chose it. This is what you wanted. You know, really, you were born as someone with heterosexual urges, heterosexual impulses.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You chose to pursue these homosexual ones.
Yeah.
Which makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, that's very unfair for someone to start dictating what somebody else's experience was in that regard. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, anything else on that point? Okay, fifth point. Some sexual behaviors, some behaviors, but we're talking about sexual ethics here, so some sexual behaviors and some sexual desires are morally disgusting. Now, I emphasize the word morally. they are morally disgusting, because there's different ways for things to be disgusting. Now, let me define what I mean by that. The Old Testament especially, it's used about a handful of times, half a dozen times in the New Testament, but it's used hundred some times in the Old Testament. The word abomination or abominable or detestable, sometimes they translate it. What it seems to be talking about is something that is just sort of wrenchingly bothersome, wrenchingly vexing. I've lost for words here. But we use the word disgusting, I think, to describe that kind of thing. When I have a visceral reaction to something because I really don't like it, I have a negative visceral reaction to something, and it's almost bodily, it's almost physical response. That's disgusting, right? The Greek word is bdelugma. I can't pronounce it. Bdelugma. And let me correct this. I don't know what happened in my notes. There's actually two words in Hebrew. It's either shekutz or toeva in Hebrew. And those two words are the two words that mostly occur, that get translated an abomination or abominable or detestable, that kind of thing. Now, what's going on there? In the Old Testament, in the law, you have all kinds of different sorts of things that are called an abomination. So it's an abomination, according to the Mosaic law, if you offer up a certain kind of offering to God. I think they translated a peace offering, and you actually eat part of the offering, it's an abomination to God. Now, to give you the context, most of the offerings that you offer up to God, you take the animal that you're going to offer to the priest. The priest, right there at the altar, takes the blood from the animal, drains the animal, and then basically butchers the animal, divides it into different cuts of meat. Some of them go to the Levites and priests to be eaten by them. It's literally their groceries. It's their meat market, and it goes to them to eat. Some of the animal is burnt on the altar up to God and incinerated, and the smoke rises up to God as an offering to God. For most of the offerings, some of the cuts of meat go back to you, the worshiper, and you take them and eat them. And there may be ways that you're prescribed. You have to eat it today, and you have to eat it with people and celebrate. There are various things that you have to do with the meat, but oftentimes it involves you eating them. But on this particular kind of offering, none of it's yours. None of it belongs to you. You're not supposed to eat any of it. If you do, it's an abomination, it says. Well, an abomination to whom? We have to ask that question. Who is it an abomination to? It's an abomination to God. So I think what that's saying is, this is highly offensive to God. This is outrageous in God's eyes that you would do that. In the early part of Exodus, the word is used to talk about the Egyptians. The Egyptians won't eat with the Hebrews because it's an abomination to them. It's just outrageously, ridiculously disgusting that you would actually eat next to a Hebrew, dine with a Hebrew. And there was something else and the argument that Moses gives to Pharaoh for why they have to go to Mount Sinai to worship God is, well, you see, here's the problem. When we have to make some offerings to God, and what we're going to offer to God is disgusting to the Egyptians, is an abomination to the Egyptians. So we need to get away from here so that we can worship God in the way that God prescribes without being offensive to the Egyptian. It's an abomination. Okay, what does that mean? The Egyptians would find this highly offensive. They would have an attitude of disgust toward it. Idolatry is an abomination to God in the Old Testament. What else? Touching any human uncleanness. I assume he means bodily functions, bodily fluids, feces, maybe. Touching that makes you unclean, and it is an abomination to touch it. Or to touch an unclean animal is an abomination. To eat various things is an abomination. Food from the sea, if it doesn't have scales, if it's not fish and it's from the sea, that's an abomination. Certain birds are an abomination when you eat them. Winged insects, if you eat them, is an abomination. Certain carcasses, if you eat them, it's an abomination. Reptiles, swarming things, if you eat them, it's an abomination. But in idolatry, witchcraft, divination, anyone who counsels Israel to follow other gods, there's a whole chapter on that, of all the various ways that someone might counsel you to follow other gods, it's an abomination that they do that. Okay, but then in the same context, there's a whole chapter in Leviticus 18 about behavior that is an abomination to God that is practiced by the Canaanites. And he says it's practiced by the Canaanites, and that's why I'm driving them out of the land, is because they do these abominable things. And don't you dare copy them. Don't you emulate them. And basically, he lists them. They are various kinds of incest, various kinds of pedophilia, adultery, various kinds of sexual liaisons that are completely, totally inappropriate, including homosexuality in that list. So various forms of sexual perversion are an abomination to God. Well, in Revelation, you have the great harlot in Revelation who has a gold bowl full of all of the abominations of their porneia that she has shared with all the nations, shared with the nations or something like that, that she has made the nations drink. It's a bowl full of the abominations of their fornications. So one of the things that is highlighted and dramatized in the Old Testament as being an abomination are various forms of sexual perversion. Okay, what does it mean? Now, are sexual perversions the only abomination? I don't think so. Because I think all it means for something to be an abomination, because I mentioned that, didn't I? Idolatry is an abomination to God. What makes something an abomination, it's such a dramatic, outrageous, wrenching departure from what is true, from what God intended and from God's purpose and so on. It's just this obvious twisting. It's an obvious perversion. And by perversion, I just mean a distortion of what God intended, a departure from what he had intended and doing something else instead. That's what makes something perverse. So I have a list of things here that it seems to me would be morally disgusting. Not just immoral, morally disgusting. Cannibalism, I think, is morally disgusting. I mean, don't you respond by that by going, really? Are you kidding me? The guy dies and you eat him? It is such an outrageous, wrenching departure from what ought to be, and from how we ought to view another human being, that it's not just wrong, it's disgustingly wrong in the sense in which I'm talking about it. Sadism is not just wrong, it's kind of disgustingly wrong. I think conspicuous consumption, an extravagant, luxurious lifestyle, is disgusting. The day I heard about Jim and Tammy Baker's house that they built with all the luxury, grotesque luxury, gaudy luxury of the architecture of that house, all that they put into that house, out of donations that people gave for the service of the Lord. I mean, it makes me sick to my stomach. It's disgustingly immoral, perverse. No one should take their material resources and do that with it, do what they did with it. So I think it's disgusting. Now, could the lifestyle of the rest of us be wrong, be immoral? Yeah, but given our cultural situation and how much we've been acculturated to consumption and so on, it may not strike us in the same way as being so wrenchingly, disgustingly wrong. Instead, it's just, yeah, it's wrong. Being proud is wrong. Being over the top, arrogant, is disgusting. You get the sense of what I'm talking about? Some things are so twisted, so perverse, so out of sync with the way things they ought to be that the Bible calls them an abomination. Excessive greed, excessive cruelty. You've seen movies where the villain is literally, completely, totally heartless. He has no heart whatsoever and will inflict any amount of cruelty against another person, cruelly inflict pain against another person without blinking an eye. He's a sociopath of some kind. Doesn't it just make your blood boil? Don't you have a visceral reaction to that? I think that's an abomination to God. Now, what's going on in the Old Testament then? It seems to me that some things can be disgusting for moral reasons, but they can also be disgusting for aesthetic reasons. So pond scum is disgusting, but pond scum is not disgusting for moral reasons. I don't have any problem with the morality of pond scum. I just think it's disgusting. It's just aesthetically yucky. I think built into human beings is some kind of aversion to certain physical realities. Interestingly, a friend of mine pointed this out, and I didn't go to check it out, but I'm confident he's right. I seem to vaguely recall this. In the Mosaic Covenant, you did not defecate inside the camp. It was against the law. You went outside the camp because feces is disgusting. It doesn't have any place in a people that is a part of the people set apart for God to be a pure people. Not because there's anything immoral about feces, but something that is aesthetically disgusting then becomes symbolic in the Mosaic Covenant for that which is morally disgusting. So what is it that God prescribed? He took foods and said, those foods are disgusting. I don't want you to eat those. Now, I can't prove this, but I'm inclined to think probably those foods were already disgusting to the Hebrews. God is not taking their favorite delicacies and saying, I think that's disgusting, I don't want you to eat it. He's taking food that they think is disgusting and saying, this is disgusting food, so it's against the law to eat that disgusting food that you all agree is disgusting. Why would you make a law like that? Because for its didactic purpose, what he's saying is, I don't want you to habituate yourself to accept that which is disgusting. Not because there's anything in the realm of diet where that's relevant, but that just becomes symbolic of morality. That's exactly what we do with morality. Things that are literally morally disgusting, we can habituate ourselves to. Obviously, human beings over the course of human history have become cannibals. There are whole tribes, I don't know if there are any left, but there are whole tribes who are cannibalistic. Somewhere along the line, an ancestor got accustomed to eating people. He habituated himself to that. Did he not have an initial impulse that this was disgusting? Probably, but he got over it. And we tend to live in an age that I think would encourage us to have the courage to get over our hang-ups, to get over our hesitancies, to overcome our scruples. And what God is teaching the Hebrews in the Mosaic Covenant is there are certain disgusting things that are disgusting because they're moral, and I never want you to get over that disgust. Don't you dare get over that disgust. I think that's the point of the law. So some things are universally and objectively wrong and disgusting. Other things are only disgusting for cultural, aesthetic, idiosyncratic reasons. Sometimes things are disgusting to me that are not disgusting to you. Just who knows why, but I just find them yucky. But we can overcome any disgust that we might have for anything. We can overcome it, but having the ability to overcome it doesn't make it right and doesn't mean we should overcome it. Did you have
it? The question was how you determine if something is culturally or morally wrong. You answer that, so.
Well, I haven't fully answered how you determine that. That you have to determine that from, that's why I stressed at the very beginning of the class, my moral judgments, both in the region of sexuality and anything else, my moral judgments ultimately need to be made against the backdrop of the entire biblical worldview and everything it teaches, not just isolated verses, text here, text there. I have to understand the biblical worldview, and that includes understanding what sexuality is. If I understand the Bible's worldview with respect to sexuality, then I'll be able to know whether when God says this is an abomination, does he mean it's morally abominable, or does he only mean it's culturally abominable? I'll have the resources to be able to make that determination, because I understand what sexuality is, and I would understand what a perversion of it is then.
So are you saying that each individual is going to, when he first encounters the moral activity or the idea of it, they're going to have a reaction to it, a bit being morally disgusting? Or are you saying that, depending on their culture, like they might not because their culture doesn't have it, and there was some point in their culture that they did, and someone just ignored that?
Yeah, because I think if you're born in a cult, in a cannibalistic tribe, you probably take it for granted. Never occurs to you to be disgusted about eating your cousin or eating your enemy, I guess, is what you're eating.
Yeah. Because it seems like, you know, you can have something that's morally disgusting, and you can have someone that they recognize as being morally disgusting, but they kind of pursue that because they might be drawn to it as being morally disgusting. I mean,
right.
You have people that will admit something, you know, yeah, this is morally disgusting, but I enjoy it, I love it, or something.
Right.
And then you have other people that are pursuing something that they don't believe or doesn't seem to be morally disgusting to them, and maybe it is. And it seems like in today's culture, like, homosexuals don't find it morally disgusting. And it seems like
sure.
That's kind of the main, one of the differences. Like,
sure.
They don't have this reaction to it of, oh, this is morally disgusting. So you could have someone that, from the beginning, you know, maybe never saw it as being something disgusting, or maybe saw it as something that seemed beautiful and pure to them. Or just under the wrong impression, whether that's culturally or, I don't know.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, not just homosexuals. In our culture today, very few people find homosexuality morally disgusting because we have been acculturated to find it completely valid, completely acceptable, yea, even beautiful, yea, even wonderful. It's just one more version of love. So why would that be morally disgusting? We no longer have a worldview that makes it morally disgusting. What would make it morally disgusting from the standpoint of human rationality would be the backdrop of the worldview that actually is, the biblical worldview. So if we've abandoned the biblical worldview and just decided that's a bunch of bunk, then it only stands to reason that our culture isn't going to look at any kind of sexual perversion, not just homosexuality, but any kind of aberration from the ethics of the Bible. No reason why we would think it's morally disgusting. I mean, right? I mean, adultery, you know, we just completely take that as, yes, happens.
It seems like adultery, though, people in general find that to be a morally disgusting action today.
Not some subcultures, not some segments.
And then maybe you already answered this, but it seems like you started by saying we can't go by what we feel, and then you bring in it's evil because it's morally disgusting, which is on some level like a feeling that we have towards it.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't say it's evil because it's morally disgusting. I would say it's evil because it doesn't conform to God's purposes. And one of the reactions that we will have to that, I'm trying to make sense out of why would the Bible call it an abomination?
Okay. You're not saying we come to it being an abomination based on the fact that we personally find it morally disgusting.
No.
You're just saying the Bible says it's morally disgusting, and this is what it means by that.
Yeah. How do we make sense out of that? How do we make sense out of what it's saying? And one of the critical issues here is there's a wide range of things that the Bible considers morally disgusting. So let's not just focus on homosexuality, or for that matter, let's not just focus on sexual perversion. One of the things that's called an abomination in the New Testament is the self-righteous hypocrisy of the Pharisees. It's called an abomination. Jesus thinks it's morally disgusting.
One other thing also. So it seems like a lot of times when things are morally disgusting, or when things are just evil in general, according to a biblical worldview, they're usually temporally, even just temporally, are destructive, harmful to other people, harmful to ourselves, even things like that. And it seems like looking at this list, the majority of things are, but it doesn't seem like homosexuality is necessarily. I mean, you can say it's destructive to your soul or something like that long term, but temporally, it doesn't seem like homosexuality is necessarily
right.
Damaging or destructive.
Right. I think I have a point coming up that will address that and we'll explore it more, but the biblical sexual ethics is not consequentialist. A consequentialist ethic says something is wrong because it has bad, harmful, evil consequences. That you look at the harm that it does to people and it brings more harm than good into the world. That's why we call it immoral. That's why it's wrong. That's not the biblical ethic. Who does blasphemy harm? I mean, I think God's a big boy. He can handle it. He just brushes it off. He's got a pretty good self-image. Not really harming God, not harming anybody else. And yet, it's an abomination. Idolatry, who is that harming? You could make the case for the harm that comes culture-wide and stuff like that, but that's not normally how we're thinking of this. I mean, you could do the same thing with homosexuality then. If you want to make a broader social argument about what if the whole culture were to be homosexual, or what if we were to embrace it, what's going to ultimately happen to the family? And when that happens to the family, what happens? You know, you could make a larger social case, but never mind that. Normally what we mean by nobody's harmed by it is I'm not immediately and directly inflicting harm on another person. I'm just making a choice for myself. Well, what about idolatry then? I'm not immediately and directly harming anybody else. I'm just making a choice for myself. I don't like Yahweh. I don't want to worship him. I want to worship this God instead. That should be something I do in the privacy of my own life. So leave me alone. Back off. Don't bug me. But from a biblical perspective, yeah, that's true. In that sense, you may not be doing any direct harm to anybody else, but it's an abomination. It's highly perverse, highly immoral, completely a manifestation of human evil, depravity, wickedness that ultimately damns me, condemns me. So that's another, I think the point coming up is that modern culture is very consequentialist in their evaluation, in how they make moral judgments, not so the Bible.
So if consequences are not a way to measure right...
Well, let me back off. I'm not saying consequences are irrelevant and are not taken into account and are not germane, but they're not definitive. Okay. They don't define right and wrong.
Well, my question was going to be, so when I determine right and wrong, am I primarily looking at my conscience?
Well, you're looking at consequences. You're taking into account your worldview, and therefore, ultimately, I would argue, what makes something wrong is it's being out of sync with the purposes of the creator of the universe. That's what makes it wrong. And some of the things that are out of sync with the purposes of God in the universe are, as it happens, quite frequently going to be harmful to other people. That's true. So the harmful consequences are a huge signal that something is wrong here, something is amiss. But there are other ways which we can be out of sync with God's purposes for the universe that don't immediately signal that fact by having observable harm that I'm doing to other people. But they're still wrong because they're still a perversion of what God intended a human being to be and a perversion of how God intended a human being should behave. So what I really need to do is make a rational judgment about, does this conform to the way reality is, to the way God intended it, the way God purposed it? And that takes a certain amount of knowledge. It takes wisdom. It takes sophistication.
Seems like you could make mistakes.
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah, absolutely you can make mistakes. And I'm just taking this for granted, but it probably needs to be said. But I'm just taking this for granted. The Christian life is not about not making mistakes in any way, and including sexually. We have all made mistakes sexually. We have all been perverse sexually. We are all wrong sexually. It's not about doing it right, getting it right. It's about coming to the self-knowledge that where did my sexual mistakes come from? Where did my evil come from? From me. It's a problem built into the very nature of who I am. God have mercy upon me, a sinner. That's where this all needs to lead, ultimately, because that's the only place it can lead. We can't reform society. We can't reform ourselves. We can't change ourselves. We can't purify ourselves. We can't transcend our sinfulness. Any Christian teaching that says we can is a diabolical lie. No, we're helplessly trapped in the depravity and evil that defines us from the get-go. But are we willing to admit it? And are we willing to call our depravity depravity and call our sin sin and call evil evil? That's the critical life and death issue that we all need to come to terms with. And I don't even know why I'm saying that.
So figuring out what our moral and immoral choices is not necessarily going to be in my conscience. I'm not necessarily going to see it. It's ultimately a process.
Yeah, exactly. Because my conscience, what we call conscience, is a cultural artifact, I would argue. When Paul says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of our mind, I would argue, using modern language, he could say, do not be conformed to this world. Train your conscience. Your conscience is no good. It needs to be trained. Because my conscience, as we normally think of conscience, is a product of cultural forces that has taught us what to get excited about and not get excited about, what to feel guilty about, what not to feel guilty about. My conscience, I can end up feeling guilty about things I have no business feeling guilty about. And on the other hand, I can feel completely not guilty about stuff I should feel guilty about. My conscience needs to be trained, and that's where learning, knowledge, understanding, wisdom gained from the Bible is absolutely critical to training my conscience so that my conscience will be in line with true moral judgment, with sound moral judgment. Because it's not automatically there. I think I grew up thinking that the conscience was basically infallible. If it made you feel guilty, it was wrong. If it didn't make you feel guilty, then it was probably right. And where I really came to understand that is my conscience had been trained to think that alcohol was absolutely, essentially evil. And I know some of you have heard this story, but to the point where the only recurring nightmare I ever had was being chased by a street gang that caught up with me, pinned my arms and legs to the ground, pried my mouth open, and took an eyedropper with alcohol, and a drop of alcohol touched the tip of my tongue. I get this sense of incredible defilement overcoming me, and then I wake up. I had that nightmare more than once. Well, that's how ingrained it was in me that alcohol is intrinsically evil. Well, when I took my first drink of alcohol in a context in which I felt obligated by the love of Christ to do so, that's a long story, but when I did that, my head was pounding. Jack, you dirty, filthy, disobedient, rebellious. But I knew enough from the Bible at that point and had received some pretty sound Bible teaching that just the other side of my mind said, Jack, shut up. This isn't true. Shut up. You're not doing anything disobedient, so shut up. Well, that was me training, taming my conscience, which had been given me by my culture, not by God.
We have a couple of questions from online. Karina wants to make the statement, and she's going to ask if this is in line with what you're saying. So she says, seems like finding something repulsive could just be a feeling not based in reason. So it seems like Jack is saying that we need to check those feelings of disgust against the biblical worldview.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And what if I find that a feeling of disgust is just not a moral issue at all? Do I need to get over it? No, not necessarily. It's not a moral issue. I can be disgusted at palm scum if I want to, and you can't stop me. You know? I mean, God doesn't care.
The next question is, Gil is asking, so in today's culture, visceral reaction isn't really helpful. It could just as easily be homophilia as moral disgust.
So could you just repeat that one more time?
So in today's culture, a visceral reaction isn't really helpful. It could just as easily be homophilia as moral disgust.
Does anyone understand? I'm not sure.
Well,
I understand.
It was from when we were talking about how in today's culture, the idea of being morally disgusting, it's not really morally disgusting to people anymore. And so when you're talking about, I think what he's just asking is maybe the way today's culture views it, if you're talking about, hey, you should stop this because it's morally disgusting, for all they realize or we realize, whatever, it could just as much be homophilia as it could be moral disgust.
Homophobia.
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 Oh, homophobia.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's how, you know, what I'm calling a moral disgust at homosexuality, I would be accused of being homophobic. Absolutely, no question about it. But homophobic is a four-letter word, just an insult you throw at somebody. It's not a sober, rational critique. I mean, the issue is it right or is it wrong? I mean, don't call me a name, give me an argument. Explain to me how it is that this is not a perversion of what God intended. Now, anyone who doesn't believe the biblical worldview isn't even going to take the time for that. They don't even believe the biblical worldview. But I'm not talking to people who don't believe the biblical worldview. I'm not. I don't know how to persuade them at this point. Certainly not. I certainly wouldn't start with homosexuality. My concern is with believers who really do have made a decision. They've made a commitment to want to follow Jesus. I want to try to give them some tools to help them not be confused by our culture. And so one of the things that you have to do to not be confused by our culture is don't plant your feet in the worldview of the modern culture. Plant your feet in the worldview of the Bible. And from the perspective of the Bible, is homosexuality a perversion of what God intended? Well, then that's the thing that counts for people like me who want to follow Jesus by living in conformity with that worldview.
And the last question is also from Gil. What makes certain sins punishable?
Talking about in the Mosaic Covenant, I assume, do you think?
I'm not sure, maybe.
Okay, well, the Mosaic Covenant is not intended for us Gentiles. And it's not even intended to be the way a society should run itself if it is not a society that is seeking to be the people of God, the unique and special people of God. It's a covenant between the people that God delivered from Egypt, brought to Mount Sinai, and said, okay, I promised Abraham that I would be your God and you will be my people. Let's do that. Let's do that thing I promised. So the Mosaic Covenant is a set of promises for what God is promising to do for them because they are his people and he is their God, and what he is obligating them to do for him because they are his people and he is their God. Well, that's unique to that people group. It's not even really, strictly speaking, relevant to the Jews as Jews. It's really only relevant to the Jews who are interested in becoming the promised people of God that he promised they were going to become with Abraham. So the punishments are unusually, the punishments by our standards are downright inhumane. I mean, if somebody blasphemes God and you know you heard them blaspheme God and you didn't stone them to death because they blasphemed God, then you're supposed to be stoned to death. That's incredibly severe and incredibly inhumane by our standards. Why? Because the whole point was the purity of the people of God. There cannot be any impurity in the hearts of the people if they are going to be the people of God. So we must eliminate all impurity. Now, the Jews never really kept that covenant. They never really acted that way. When the people come into existence in history who actually keep the covenant, there won't be much stoning going on, if any, because their hearts will be circumcised. People won't be blaspheming God. People won't be disobeying God. So there won't be these awful things happening that are prescribed as the punishments, precisely because the people of God will be the people of God and not be chafing against that. So, I mean, that there's probably more that can be said, but it makes no sense for us to even dream of taking the punishments that are prescribed in the Mosaic Covenant and somehow making them the law of the land or making them even paradigmatic for how our society should run. That, I think that would be contrary to everything the Bible teaches, because what the Bible, again, thinking in terms of the whole worldview, because what the Bible teaches is that we are depraved, evil sinners who are going to chafe at the will of God by our very nature of our being, and you can't expect purity. You can't expect perfection. So to automatically be killing people willy-nilly for every time that they sin, there wouldn't be many people left. There wouldn't be any people left. So that makes no sense.
What about, I don't know if this was what his question was getting at, but I think it's relevant to what you guys are talking about when it comes to, like he was talking about how to determine what is right or not, what do you consider your conscience or whatnot. And then you're talking about, you know, in today's culture, people are deceived or they don't see something as being morally disgusting. And so what are they, how are they punished in that sense? Like, what ultimately decides whether or not they're going to be someone who's punished or not?
What's the context? America or?
Yeah, well, just, I mean, in general, it's hard to figure out what the right thing to do is and what the wrong thing to do is. And when morality, things that the Bible says are morally disgusting, when basically you go through life trying to be committed to following God and misled into living something out that is morally disgusting. I mean, what are the consequences of that?
Okay, let me give you a brief answer, and then I need to close, and then we can talk further. But my brief answer would be, just because something is morally disgusting doesn't mean society should punish it. In fact, I think quite the contrary. Should you punish people for being self-righteous, hypocritical Pharisees? Should you execute them or scourge them or something? I don't think so. They're just being jerks. And I don't think you should punish people for being jerks. In fact, I think there'd be something wrong with that. Punishment should come for antisocial behavior, not immoral behavior. And so you have to make it some kind of distinction between, is this behavior actually destructive of society? If it's destructive of society, then there would be a reason to punish it. If it's not, then they're just being immoral. Okay, I kept you over time. I'll let you go. Sorry.